Can a 2,000-year-old collection of ancient texts offer a more sophisticated framework for understanding modern life than cutting-edge philosophy? This provocative question sits at the heart of a revolutionary approach to cultural engagement. Rather than treating scripture as a rulebook for personal piety, what if the Bible provides its own critical theory, a lens through which to analyze power, identity, freedom, and meaning? This isn't about proof-texting answers to contemporary debates. It's about discovering how the biblical narrative cuts diagonally across our most cherished assumptions, challenging both secular progressivism and religious conservatism in equal measure. The Bible refuses to play by modern rules. Where contemporary thought forces binary choices, freedom or authority, unity or diversity, individual or community, Scripture consistently offers a third way that holds supposed opposites in creative tension. This isn't compromise or middle ground thinking, it's what Chesterton called both things at the top of their energy. Consider how we typically frame freedom and authority as enemies. More rules mean less freedom, right? But biblical wisdom reveals them as dance partners. True freedom flourishes within proper boundaries, like a river's power channeled by its banks. Godly authority enables rather than restricts human flourishing. Or take the tension between universal truth and particular cultures. Philosophy has wrestled with this for millennia. Then Christ arrives, simultaneously the most particular person imaginable, a first-century Jewish carpenter from an obscure village, and the most universal, the cosmic Word through whom all things exist. The incarnation doesn't resolve the tension by choosing one side. It transcends the entire framework. This diagonal approach equips us to engage culture without being captured by it. Most philosophies start with the impersonal, atoms, energy, quantum fields, treating consciousness as evolutionary accident. The Trinity reveals ultimate reality is fundamentally personal, three persons in eternal relationship, united in essence, yet distinct in identity. If personality is fundamental rather than accidental, every human person has inherent dignity, regardless of capability or contribution. You matter not because of what you produce, but because personhood itself reflects reality's deepest nature. The implications cascade outward. The Trinity solves philosophy's ancient one and many problem. Must ultimate reality be unity or diversity? The answer, both, equally. This provides a model for society valuing both community and individuality without sacrificing either. Most radically, the Trinity reveals ultimate reality is love, not power, conflict, or survival of the fittest. From ancient creation myths born of divine warfare to modern political theories grounded in power struggles, Western thought has assumed violence lies at existence's foundation. Christianity counters with an ontology of love, where peace and relationship form reality's bedrock. In the beginning, God created. Five words that upend everything. Unlike violent ancient myths where gods battle to birth the cosmos, Genesis presents creation through divine speech alone. God doesn't need the universe. He's not lonely, incomplete, or bored. We exist from divine generosity, not divine need. This gratuity contrasts sharply with modern society's transactional paradigm, where everything becomes a commodity. The biblical vision offers an alternative. We are recipients whose primary disposition is thanksgiving, not consumers calculating value. Notice creation's extravagant abundance. God doesn't create with minimalist efficiency. The land proliferates with species. Oceans teem with life. Food doesn't merely sustain, it delights. Humans break the pattern. While other creatures are created according to their kinds, we're made in God's image, a phrase appearing nowhere else. This image-bearing provides inherent dignity independent of capabilities. Unlike other species, we're uniquely unfinished at birth, participating in our development through culture and technology. God invites us into his creative work as what Tolkien called sub-creators, neither autonomous gods nor passive recipients. When Adam names the animals, he exercises genuine creative authority within divine boundaries, pulling things from existence's background flux into meaningful order.
The line between good and evil runs through each human heart, not between groups. When asked, "What's wrong with the world?" Chesterton replied, "Dear sir, I am. Yours, G.K. Chesterton." This recognition provides democracy's strongest foundation. We need accountability because no one can be trusted with unchecked power. Sin affects our actions, thinking, motives, and understanding. We suppress truth, rationalize evil, and deceive ourselves. At sin's core lies autonomy, humans choosing to live by their own law rather than God's. When Moses commands Pharaoh to let my people go, the sentence continues, "so that they may worship me." This repetition appears 7 times in Exodus, revealing something crucial. God frees his people not for absolute autonomy, but for proper service. This challenges modern culture's teaching that authentic freedom means throwing off all constraints. Biblical wisdom suggests that service to God is liberating, perfect freedom, as Augustine put it, while protecting people from serving destructive idols or exploitative regimes. The Exodus narrative has profoundly shaped Western political thought because it reveals authentic freedom as directed toward proper service rather than mere absence of constraint.
The Word became flesh. John uses sarx, actual physical flesh, meat emphasizing Christ's genuine human embodiment, not a ghostly appearance, but real flesh and blood that could be heard, seen, and touched. This materiality counters modern excarnation, which distances us from embodiment, while late modernity simultaneously obsesses over perfect bodies and offers disembodied cyber existence. Christianity embraces corporeal reality. But the incarnation isn't merely an endorsement of materiality, it profoundly affirms personality. God became not just any material thing, but a particular human person. When John identifies the Logos with Jesus, he breaks with Greek philosophical tradition where Logos was always impersonal. This move refuses 3 crippling dichotomies, reducing truth to either abstract statements or mystical experiences, choosing between universal principles and particular cultures, and viewing reality as either completely unintelligible or utterly transparent. The incarnation reveals that the most universal truth comes clothed in radical particularity. We needn't choose between concrete experience and abstract principle, between the local and the global. Christ holds them together in his very being.
The cross subverts cultural assumptions by breaking the cycle of violence. Jesus' nonviolence wasn't self-abnegation, but self-assertion that refused to mirror his enemies. While violence traps all parties in retributive patterns, Christ's refusal to retaliate ruptures the cycle. The cross also undermines what governs both ancient Rome and modern social media, the performance narrative. It introduces status based neither on birth, pre-modern, nor performance, modern, but on grace. Everyone draws lines between the justified and condemned, conservatives between those upholding traditional values versus those scorning them, liberals between those working for inclusion versus those who aren't. Grace doesn't erase these lines, but undermines the hierarchical relation between sides. It reveals we're all on the wrong side of the line that matters most, the one between human and divine righteousness. The cross demonstrates God's love isn't earned through performance, but freely given to the undeserving. This isn't cheap grace that ignores sin's reality, but costly grace that takes sin seriously through divine self-sacrifice. This radical repositioning liberates us from proving our worth, allowing us to stop performing and start living.
We exist in the last days, the period between Christ's ascension and return. This requires a parallax view, avoiding both separatism and assimilation. Like human vision, combining 2 perspectives into depth perception, Christians must see through both the lens of current culture and God's future promises. This double position expresses itself temporally as the now and not yet of God's kingdom, and spatially as being in but not of the world. Modern society catechizes citizens through national liturgies and daily habits, television, advertising, mall layouts, smartphone interactions. The church must cultivate counter-desire to modernity's consumption-based longings. Consumption desire centers on the sovereign individual seeking endless novelty. Biblical intimacy desire involves subject-subject relationships building cumulative depth. The difference between scrolling for dopamine hits and nurturing decades-long friendship captures this contrast. The biblical narrative offers something radically different, a comprehensive story making sense of reality without flattening complexity. You're already shaped by a story. The question is which? One ending in consumption and death, or one culminating in a temple garden city where God dwells with his people and all things are made new?